This is Regionally Speaking on Lake Shore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Immigration is a major issue in the upcoming presidential election, but the issues surrounding immigration isn't just for border states like Texas or California. It affects Northwest Indiana as well. Demonstrators are demanding that the Gary Chicago International Airport stop allowing federal officials to use it to fly undocumented immigrants out of the country. Michael Puente talked about that issue on Off Mic that you heard here on Lakeshore Public Radio last week.
Ruth Needleman is a retired professor at Indiana University Northwest. She's at the Gary Airport this morning with other demonstrators to speak out against the deportations. Ruth, this has been an issue that's been ongoing, these deportations from the Gary Chicago Airport. How long has this been going on?
Well, as of April of 2017, which was a FOIA request, it said that 2,900 people had already been deported from the Gary Airport. I believe it began in 2014, and then it increased when Trump took over, and they deport people from four states, Wisconsin, Illinois, Indiana, and Kentucky. Now, it used to be two huge white buses. Now there's usually a line of vans. It's either because of the COVID-19, they don't want people in a big bus, but sometimes there's a big school bus. Today there were about five vans that drove by. And they used to take them to Brownsville. The plane comes from Brownsville, but it returns to Louisiana, and in most cases goes on to Honduras, the most dangerous country in the world.
Wow, wow. And go ahead.
I had been going out. We stopped doing the protests because they brought in the tax squad. They brought in all these armed militia kinds of police, and we couldn't see anything. But recently I decided with another person, Elizabeth Palacio, Mexican, to come out and just do a Greta Thunberg, just stand witness to this horrible thing that goes on every week. But there was so much harassment and such an effort to prevent us from seeing anything. And I mean anything. They bring in 3 to 4 tankers to block one side. They bring in small planes from the tarmac to block another side. And they use the bus and vans to block completely. So it's a 360-degree blockade so that we can see what's going on. And it was first rumored that there might have been children. And so I got a professional photographer with a big lens. And we found a spot where you could actually get a picture of the whole tarmac. And we figured out it was mainly Central American. It was very small men going on the airplane. But they pack food in the airplane, which they never did before because they went to Brownsville. And that also was suspicious because they never fed the immigrants before. But we do think that it's mainly Central Americans. The plane comes every week. Lands at 10:30, more or less. I now have a tracker, so I know when the plane is going to land. And I know more or less when the vans and bus is going to arrive. And the conditions are horrible. I mean, COVID-19 is so widespread in the detention centers, and there's been so little done to protect the health of these immigrants. They're basically a caged population who have never committed any criminal offense other than not having citizenship papers.
What do you think the city of Gary can do to pressure the Gary Chicago International Airport to end these deportation flights?
I don't think the city wants to, because even though they say they get nothing in return, most of the money goes to the Jet Center. The Gary Jet Center is privately held by former military colonel, I think, Will Davis. He has made so much money off his ICE contract that he has built 3 new hangars and office buildings. And some revenue probably comes back. And the current administration thinks that the making money is the only thing that matters for Gary, not health and safety, not protection of the residents, nothing like that. They have a cop sitting out here every week telling me I'm breaking the law. And we have a welcoming city ordinance that says they can't work for ICE or the Jet Center to protect deportations, but they do. I will be meeting with the mayor in 2 weeks because I will not allow this harassment to continue. And we want to bring it out in public. What are they hiding that they make such an effort to make sure that nobody can see what's happening? It's very suspicious and angering, and the cruelty of how they do this is intolerable.
You know, the city of Gary has said in the past that since they receive federal funds, that it cannot deny another federal agency from using the airport to do this, that they can also do it out of O'Hare and Midway if they wanted to. But do you buy that argument?
Here's the thing. There's a compact. I don't know if I ever sent you a copy, but I can. The compact says that the Gary Chicago International Airport will only serve as a reliever to O'Hare and Midway. And what that has meant is they get passenger service and we get the crap. We get deportations and cargo. And so that's part of the agreement in the compact. I also think that they can't deny, but it's the Jet Center that has the contract with ICE. And that contract, I mean, the Jet Center has made literally millions of dollars off that contract. And that's what we're going after. The city council refuses to go after any business in Gary because they think that development means we should welcome all business no matter what it does to the city. But we are going to go again. I'll speak with the mayor in 2 weeks. And then we will go to the city council again. But I do not believe they will do anything but say it's out of our hands.
And you also say that because Gary is considered a welcoming city, that it should not be allowing these flights to happen.
Well, that could be an argument, but we can't tell the federal government not to use a federal airport. But the problem is the Jet Center. And they shouldn't be doing deportations. We shut down an immigrant prison twice in the city. They wanted to build it right near the airport. And we shut it down twice. And also in Hobart and in three other cities in Indiana where they wanted to build a prison. But we have not been able to make any headway with the deportations.
All right, Ruth Needleman, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you for calling, and we need help in the city of Gary because the city of Gary is the city of Chicago is part of this deportation. And you in Chicago are not just a welcoming city, you're a sanctuary city.
All right, Ruth, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Have a good day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Ruth Needleman is a retired professor at Indiana University Northwest.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. The 2020 Indiana governor's race always looked like an uphill battle for the challengers, Democrat Dr. Woody Myers and Libertarian Donald Rainwater. A global pandemic likely only made it harder. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports on the issue that has shaped the race and whether incumbent Republican Governor Eric Holcomb's victory is all but guaranteed.
In just about any statewide race in Indiana, the typical issues voters say they care most about are jobs in the economy and education. 2020 is anything but a typical year, but in many ways the candidates for governor are still talking about those usual issues, only they're doing so through the lens of the COVID-19 pandemic. For Governor Eric Holcomb, the message is steady as she goes.
Proud of the team, proud of the areas of expertise, proud of the cross-training that's occurred. I think that's what's kind of separated us. We were informed by each sector.
Yet many, notably conservatives, including members of his party in the legislature, have vocally chafed under the governor's ongoing COVID regulations. Holcomb isn't worried about that criticism.
If it wasn't working, if these decisions weren't working, I'd be the first to say, let's try something else.
The criticism over his handling of the pandemic doesn't just come from the right, though. There are plenty on the left who think Holcomb hasn't done nearly enough, chief among them, Democratic gubernatorial candidate Dr. Woody Myers.
In order to manage something as complex as a pandemic, you need good advice and you need to take a good stand based on science and you need to lead.
Myers says he would have ramped up testing sooner, been more aggressive in securing PPE, instituted a more stringent mask-wearing requirement, and slowed down the lifting of COVID restrictions. And he's got some expertise here. Myers is a medical doctor and former Indiana State Health Commissioner. He's also the first black person to run for governor on a major party ticket in the state's history, in a year when there's a bright spotlight on racial injustice. Holcomb, to confront that issue, announced he'll hire a cabinet officer to address racial inequity and review law enforcement training at the State Police Academy. Myers scoffs at the timing. Convenient, he says, right before an election.
I'm not going to need a special officer to look over the work of everybody else and then report on how everybody else is doing. I'm going to hire people from the beginning who know how important diversity is, who know how important inclusion is.
Myers undoubtedly has a compelling profile, particularly this year. So why hasn't he gained more traction? Political scientist Andrew Downs says some of it is bad timing.
I think he probably had a lot of voters, as well as donors, et cetera, who were thinking that it was going to be a cakewalk for Eric Holcomb. Then as the racial issues and then eventually things like COVID, by then it was almost too late to mount a traditional campaign.
Gone this year have been the typical door-to-door campaigning, the house parties, and fundraising dinners. Instead, it's things like Zoom meetings, which Downs says aren't a true replacement.
The best way of campaigning is candidate-to-voter contact, direct contact.
But the race isn't a sure thing either, particularly considering the third candidate, Libertarian Donald Rainwater.
Citizens of the state of Indiana, they're tired of being told one thing during campaign season, and then getting a different type of government than what they were promised. And I think that they're starting to say enough's enough.
Rainwater says Holcomb's response to COVID has been far too restrictive and that the government can't solve racial injustice. So can the Libertarian affect the race? Downs says it's absolutely on the table.
If Rainwater is able to get to 10%, that may not be enough. But certainly by the time you're talking 15 or even 20%, then absolutely, if the majority of those voters are coming from the Republican candidate, then the Democratic candidate should have a shot.
Libertarian gubernatorial candidates haven't broken 4% support in the final vote in the last three decades. But 2020 is anything but a typical year. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
We've been checking from time to time with some of the public libraries here in Northwest Indiana as they're dealing with the COVID-19 health crisis. Let's find out more in particular about the Hammond Public Library. And with us from the Hammond Public Library, we have Assistant Director Carol Williams. Carol, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Thanks so much for having me, Chris.
Well, bring us up to date, if you will, first about how the library had to deal with a sudden shutdown back in the spring months here as the pandemic was really, really gripping us hard. What was the impact on the Hammond Public Library?
Well, like all organizations, it came as a complete shock. We weren't prepared in advance for what was going to happen since it really was unprecedented. We closed our doors for March 17th, which was a Tuesday. We were open on the Monday, business as usual, and when we got the word that we were going to be closing, all of our librarians were scrambling to take home as many items, materials, that they possibly could so that they could work from home. So our youth librarians were taking home stacks and stacks of storybooks to work on programming from home. Our adult and teen librarians were, taking home craft supplies and books for online book discussions and all that stuff. We shut down. We were holding meetings virtually with each other from home to try to plan things out. Lots of extensive phone calls to get something, planned and working. And we were able to start using Facebook and videos of getting online programs. So even though our doors were closed for those roughly 2 months, we were still able to provide you know, some sort of programming and interaction with the public.
Now, obviously, during that time that you were physically closed, you had the opportunity, I suppose, to take a look at what all the safety guidelines would be so you could try to reopen the building and probably had to do a lot of retooling and refitting like all the other libraries, right?
A lot of that, yes. Yeah. And as things, you know, were being known publicly about the virus and all of that, we had to constantly be changing our plans based on, you know, what all of the experts were saying.
Would you have any idea how many times you had to change things around before you finally got to stay on one particular guideline?
Well, that's easier said than done, yeah. Because even once we reached the stage where we opened, things, you know, the governor was changing his orders. We were moving back and forth into different stages, especially here in Lake County, and we had to adjust mid-stride. But our staff has been fabulous in readjusting themselves and how they work throughout the day to adjust to, you know, the ups and downs of this thing.
Now, bring us up to date, at least physically, what all had to be changed within the Hammond Public Library. It's probably very similar to many of the other public libraries around Lake County and mm-hmm. the region as well, but it may have had to do some specific things because you have a specific building.
Yes. For a time, we limited, we normally have two entrances, one mm-hmm. on the east and the west side of our buildings. For a time, we limited that only to the main entrance on our east side, simply because we could better manage the flow of traffic and keep people, you know, keep them in their lanes as they're coming in and out. So contact was reduced. So that was difficult to get used to. Currently, though, both of our entrances are open, so we've got a good control over the flow now. But we've had to move furniture numerous times. Like other locations around the county, we've had to put the markings on the floor. We've got plexiglass plates in front of all of our public desks. So the staff that have to work at those desks and go face-to-face with the public, we've got that extra added protection for both the patron and the staff.
Now, you mentioned that early on here, in fact, almost as soon as you found out that you had to make the shutdown very quick, and you said librarian staff members were taking things home to be able to do things from home. Mm-hmm. Were these a lot of things that were in the works, like summer reading programs and activity programs and the like, that you had to at least try and, if you thought that you could reopen fairly soon, that you could be able to get back in place?
Well, we're not that far ahead into summer reading, but definitely the programs that were scheduled for the remainder of March mm-hmm. and April, you know, our librarians plan months in advance for their programs, so they knew what the topics were, what materials that they were going to use. So instead of keeping them on hand in a programming room, they took them all home with them.
Now, tell us, for people here in Northwest Indiana that may not know, when did the Hammond Public Library get to reopen here after the shutdown?
Well, you know, I believe that, you know, each library needs to do what's best for their community. We reopened earlier than many of the libraries did. We reopened to the public on Tuesday, May 26th, so right after Memorial Day. We opened with very limited services. It was first floor access only. We had a patron limit of only 20 people at a time in the building. And it was basically pick up your materials or request materials, and you had a 30-minute computer use limit, and then that was it. But primarily what we found was people needed access to the copy machine to make important copies. They needed to fax things. And they were just so relieved that, oh my God, I've got somewhere I can go to get this done. I've been stuck at home for months. And though they were very appreciative, even with the limited services that we could offer when we first reopened.
We're talking with Carol Williams. She's the assistant director of the Hammond Public Library, about how the library in downtown historic downtown Hammond has been coping with the coronavirus pandemic. The changes had to be made and getting the library reopened. Now, the programs that normally happen during the summer, I know where lots of people come in and out of the building, obviously were limited. What programs were you able to accomplish once we were able to reopen there on May 26th?
Mm-hmm. Our programming online, you know, the programs that they could do online continued on. Our actual in-person programming didn't resume until August, but that still left a big gap for us during June and July, which are, for all libraries, those are your peak months, especially for children.
Yeah.
And so we took a big hit on our summer reading. We had much fewer people participating. But what we did differently this year because of COVID is we developed take-home kits. So when we knew that there was a program on the schedule, we put the word out there that, okay, if you want your kids to participate from home for this particular program, let us know how many of these kits you need, make arrangements to come and pick them up, and then your children could participate in the program virtually from home because we would provide you all of the necessary items for the program.
Were you able to do any type of a summer reading programs, or even if it had to be done virtually, or at least set up virtually?
Well, the overall, you know, initiative for keeping up with reading during the summer, last year we started using a program called Beanstack. And so you manage your, you know, your library reading and recording of your books through this app. It's also available on the computer. So many of the families were already familiar with using it from the previous year. So we were using that, we were planning on using that for this past summer anyway. So for many families, there wasn't any interruption because they were already using this. But the biggest obstacle was browsing for the books that your family likes to read.
I see. Yeah. Well, now we get to into, of course, now, what programs are underway now that you're back in? Are you not almost, but not quite, at the normal stage, such as it is?
Well, we have resumed normal programming. We are continuing our virtual programming. It is, you know, a weird situation. There's many people who still don't feel comfortable coming to a program with a lot of strangers, and we understand that. So we're not scheduling as many in-person programs as we used to. You know, hopefully, as this thing rides itself out over time, you know, we'll be able to resume that heavier calendar. But we do still offer in-person programs. And for many of our programs, there is an online component. So maybe if we record it, you can watch it from home, either live streamed or in an archive fashion from either the Facebook or our YouTube channel.
Well, that's great to hear. Now, you mentioned early on here that many of the patrons that rely on the library to be able to copy off important documents or fax out materials were happy that when the library was able to reopen. Yeah. What's been the general reaction from Hammond Public Library patrons, and especially about being able to reopen so quickly, so to speak?
Well, we get a lot of, I didn't realize you guys were open, or how long have you been open? Because so many things for so long were shut down, they just assumed we were as well. Even though we tried to get the word out, letting them know that, you know, we were open in a limited capacity for this time. You know, we were open back to full use, you know, at a later time. A lot of surprise and a lot of gratitude that, hey, now I have somewhere I can go and do this. You know, the people that are coming to use our study rooms and our computers are just very grateful to have this, you know, this outlet.
Well, Carol, thank you very much for the great information. We're glad to hear that the Hammond Public Library is moving back in towards the at least the new normal, as it may be.
Yeah.
And hopefully it's been a benefit, not only of the learning process for everybody with the COVID-19 pandemic, but also for the community as well, to be able to know that the library's been able to come bounce back and be back in service as quickly as much as it has. And we thank you very much for spending time with us to talk about it.
Thank you for having us.
Carol Williams is the Assistant Director of the Hammond Public Library. You're listening to Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. Thank you very much for joining us, and thanks to our guests for being with us today. Coming up on tomorrow's program, Julian Marsh of the Gary Housing Authority will talk about the organization's participation in a national movement to bridge the digital divide. And Ambulatory Director for Franciscan Health, Craig Miller, will also be with us to bring us up to date on the health system's virtual urgent care. Hope you'll join us.